What's up, everybody? It's Armand Uno, the Curious Californian, Kid with the Questions, back at it again with another episode, this time featuring Kyle Van Boris. He's the CEO and founder of Boris, which is a company that helps startups grow high-performing B2B sales teams. Now, oftentimes, they do that from scratch. They do that with Kyle's blueprint, which he personally has used to grow a sales team at a startup 600%, raising $21 million in a Series B funding round. Because of that, wow. I've personally gone through some of Boris's sales training with the team, and I can attest, I used to sound like a floundering fish on the phones, but now, thanks to Kyle, I sound like a champion on the dial. Get ready to listen to his hobbies, what he does for fun, how he does it, and he drops some real truth about what it's like being a CEO. I really like talking to him, and I hope you like listening. With that, welcome to the Player.
Work hard, play hard. Work hard, play hard. Work hard.
More just like you, so it doesn't work out.
I love the hat, by the way, Santorini.
Thanks. I had to wear my, I had to represent for my Greek friend coming on the podcast.
I know, I appreciate it. Yeah, I love that island.
Yeah, dude, it was so much fun. But yeah, let's get right into it. So you started Boris, which helps founders and other startups build and scale their. I know I've talked to you a lot about the vision where it's going to go, but for right now, the current structure is you guys are building out the sales teams. Can you talk a little bit about that? What exactly you guys do at Boris?
Yeah, so we work with typically earlier stage startup companies. Not always the case, but typically on the earlier side. And we help them build their first inside sales team. And sometimes that looks like just SDRs. Other times that looks like a mix of SDRs and AEs. It could also just be AEs. It depends on the client. And we have a process that we take clients through that we have to customize based on their industry vertical and, you know, their kind of their growth strategy as it sits today to help them build those teams in a sustainable way.
Nice. Yeah. And I've seen firsthand that you guys do a great job of building those teams and the way you track everything with metrics, you kind of turned it into a science and it's just very easy to repeat, follow and do.
I was just agreeing with you. We take a super data-driven approach, and I think that's important with almost anything that you do. I take data very, very seriously.
Yep. Again, can confirm. But so you actually started as an SDR, and your very first role. I love that story. I remember you told it to me when we first met. Can you tell me the first time you became an SDR? Kind of what drove you to reach that success? And honestly, like, go through the path of how you ended up starting Boris.
Sure. So it all started when I dropped out of college, probably, because what had happened was I got a job. First of all, I was not very good at school. So I was pretending to go to college. I was failing most of my classes except like speech and psychology. Like I aced every psychology class and I aced every speech class. So
as I always said, school gets in the way of college.
Yeah, there you go. Right. Very true. So, anyway, I got a job selling gym memberships at a gym called Crunch Fitness. And I was at this suburban club and I liked it. I was doing pretty well. I was making more money than I was doing anything else. Didn't like school. And I was doing stand-up comedy like every night I was going out and performing. So what I did was dropped out of college, decided I'm going to do stand-up full-time. I'm going to work at the gym because I can kind of work there in the mornings and I can do stand up at night. And this is going to be my life for a while until I'm a famous comedian and everybody knows who I am. Well, the latter didn't happen. But what ended up happening was my boss at Crunch Fitness went to a company called Intuit and he got me an interview there. They overlooked the fact that I didn't have a degree and they hired me as an SDR. And that's really where my career started. So I was an SDR at Intuit. Really, really tough environment. I mean, people were getting fired or quitting left and right, really high turnover. You know, we're supposed to be making 100 calls a day. It was like 80 to 120 calls a day, whatever it was. And we were, or me specifically, I was calling salons and spas and selling marketing automation software to them or trying to get a meeting for the sales reps. I ended up getting promoted there. It's a pretty kind of intense environment. As a salesperson, then I left to go sell at a different company. after a certain point, I wanted to write a book on sales development because there weren't a lot of resources back then. This was in like 2014 or so, 2015. And there just wasn't a lot of books and stuff out there. So I ended up leaving writing a book. Then I started I came out of my book writing time and got a job managing a sales development team at a company called Forrestall. It was an early stage financial technology company. Ended up scaling that SDR organization to 14 people. We were doing somewhere around 300,000 calls every month. It was really, really high volume. We were using dialers and whatnot. Ended up having a very successful Series B round. After that, I went to go repeat the process at a place called the Bloom Global, where we were having a lot of success. COVID hit. We sold to shippers, you know, so the transportation, the supply chain got disrupted very early on in COVID.
Still is.
That's very true. They let go of my team and they kept me in like a, you know, in a different capacity than my normal job because they were thinking we were going to rebuild the team or whatever. And after a few months, I decided what was a side hustle of mine, which was doing a little consulting on the side, decided to turn into an actual business. And that was almost 2 years ago, probably a little over a year and a half here. And it's been fantastic ever since.
Yeah. And kind of what inspired that leap that you made from part-time to full-time? Because I know that, first of all, it takes a lot of risk. And you really were probably, I don't know, was it scary at that time? Like what inspired it and how did you feel when you were taking that jump?
Maybe a little bit. I wouldn't say scary. I've never had a problem getting money. So if like, and I say this a lot, like getting money is pretty easy. Like, can I provide value to somebody else? And are they willing to pay for that value? If the answer is yes, and I can get the money, but I'm very comfortable selling. So since I have the skill set, both on the SDR side to be able to find people to pay, and then also on the sales side, to be able to close deals, I never really had a concern about running out of money. So I wouldn't say scary, but I was definitely stressed because I always had a really big vision for Vorus. And I do, and it just keeps growing and growing. Like my vision gets bigger and bigger. And because of that, it can be a little stressful when you don't really know where to start. And early on when you have a company, it's very difficult. Because you're like, I want to do all these things, but I don't know what to put my time and attention into that's going to yield good results. Looking back on it, I probably did the right thing with where I focused, but at the time, you just don't know. You know. And then eventually I brought Leo onto the team. That made it a lot easier. And then we kept growing. And you know, now we have 12 people, including me.
Yeah. And the fact that you've been growing 2 years, like that's when you guys started, was right around COVID. You're growing the team. Yeah, it's been good. And I mean, working for a startup that was trying to build their sales team at the time, I very much saw the problem that you guys solved like firsthand. It was learning how to prospect. When I was in college and people would tell me like, you would be good in sales. Okay. So I go into sales. I didn't know that there was a whole cycle, like an entire, like you have to prospect. First, you have to find the people. I thought it's like people come to you. They're like, oh, we really want like cybersecurity, whatever. And then there you go. You're like, oh, nice. Cool. Now let's keep the customer happy. No, like you have to find the whole prospecting to me was the biggest like, wow.
Right.
Actually finding these people. I think you do a good job of teaching that.
Well, it's difficult too, because every industry is different. You know, you prospect into an industry that's very difficult. You know, very, very challenging. And it takes a little bit longer and you try different things and you practice. And over time, you start building more of a pipeline and you can start converting on that pipeline. You just get better and better. But it's difficult, man. I mean, growing a company is always challenging. And there's so many different ways to do it. And there's so many variables that you just got to prioritize certain things. Like we've built a process, so it's a little bit easier. But still, we have clients that come to us that are in a whole new industry. We have to think on our feet. We have to customize things. So it doesn't, it never gets super, super easy, unfortunately. But as long as like the people who are behind the growth of an organization are really coachable, they're willing to learn, they execute well, and then they collect data and they use that data to make better decisions. And you can usually get to a good place over, you know, six months, 8 months.
Yeah. I think being coachable is a really big part of the learning how to, honestly, like any role, any job, there's always something to learn. Yeah. And I think thinking that you already know what's up and what you're doing, like, I don't know, being coachable is very important.
Well, and I'll give you a real example of this. Our client who's gotten the best results, the CEO and founder, whenever something comes up, he's like, what is that? I don't know what that is. Tell me more about that. Hey, Kyle, is there something I should ask you that I'm not asking you? Like, he's constantly trying to figure out.
Great question.
Yeah, that is a good question.
That's a great question.
Yeah, and it's kind of amazing. You know, like when I first mentioned SKO, which is a sales kickoff, I said, yeah, we should absolutely do an SKO. And I was in front of all the sales reps. So this is the founder of the company, the CEO, in front of all of the sales reps at the organization and me. The sales reps bring up a SKO. I say, yeah, we should definitely do an SKO. He says, Kyle, what's an SKO? In front of all the salespeople. Like, if that's not a coachable person, I don't know who is. Because this man could totally set aside his own insecurities and ask questions that are so simple. Like, his reps know what an SKO is, he doesn't. But the fact that he's willing to ask it in front of everybody and he's not ashamed about it is really admirable to me. And they're absolutely crushing it. So I agree. I think coachability is incredibly important.
Yeah. And there's actually, that reminds me of like a small anecdote I heard of actually Napoleon. What I heard this off of a podcast actually, that apparently when he was made some sort of leader, I don't want to get the position wrong, he was made some sort of leader of all of the artillery in the French army at the time, and he was pretty young, he was like in his mid to late 20s. There's naturally people way older than him at this going on, and Napoleon showed up and he started asking everyone all these questions because he was in a location totally foreign to him. The other guys have already been there, much older, much more experienced, but he was leading them and he asked all of them questions. And at first they were like, who's this young guy who's like coming in to push us around? But everyone there gained respect for him because not once did he try to pretend like he knew what he was doing just because he was at that role. He was like, no, I don't know anything, but hey, what better way than to ask questions of everyone who already does? And let's get this together. And if you know, like Napoleon's record, they won whatever battle it was. He won like all of them.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. And I think it is a really good skill. And the best leaders have it.
Yeah. And so you mentioned that there's been a lot of challenges. And I've talked to you about this before, how this is, you've said, starting a company, hardest thing you've ever done.
Yeah.
What have been some of the big challenges that you've faced throughout your journey of Boris?
Probably the biggest one was knowing when to hire other people. That was, at least it pops in my head, is the biggest one. So I'm fortunate because my dad was an entrepreneur before he retired. He retired at 45. And he was a great entrepreneur. He did really well for himself. Ended up also getting into real estate. His like main business ended up funding his real estate portfolio, and then he retired pretty young. So a really strong entrepreneur. And he always told me to avoid hiring employees at all costs. He like put the fear of God in me about hiring people. And I'll never forget, I was just, my calendar, I was just booked like crazy. I'm just in back-to-back meetings all day. You know, I forget how many clients we had at this point, but it was a good amount. And it's, oh yeah, at the time it was just me servicing all of them. And I was just up to my eyeballs. And I'm talking to my dad. I'm like, I'm going to die. This is just too many meetings. And my dad just goes, so why don't you hire somebody? As if it was like the simplest. I mean, because you tell me never to hire anybody. He's like, yeah, but you need to now. And I was like, all right, you jerk. But I just didn't see it. And I went way too long before we hired our first person. And
was the first person Leo, or is this you and Leo?
No, this was actually, yeah, the first person was Dan, actually.
Okay. Oh, he was the first hire?
Yeah, he was our first hire. Yeah.
Funny.
Really, really.
Great first hire. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Fantastic. Dan's the man. So yeah, we got really fortunate there, but it took me way too long. Like I should have tried to hire somebody a bit earlier. But also like, you don't know who to hire. They, you know, everyone gives you advice where it's like, oh, your first person should be more of an assistant and stuff. So there's a bunch of like frameworks you could try to follow, but kind of think of where's the business need and like, where can, especially our business, like it requires a lot of expertise. So you got to think like, where can I plug somebody in? And Dan was a really good fit for that. So knowing what to hire was probably the biggest challenge. Other than that, you just run into, you know, like little road bumps, like invoicing, you know, like, or just cash flow in general, where you're like, wait, why does it take 30 days for us to get paid from people? What's our process for collecting payments? Like, there's all this stuff. You know, legal stuff too that you
sometimes
don't know.
You have to chase down people just to get your money that's owed to you. Like,
right. And it's, you know, it's just a weird, it's just weird. And you know about these things, like, you know, people can tell you, they can tell you, they give you all the advice in the world, but until you're there and experiencing it, you don't really get it. And sometimes you learn things that looking back on, you could have avoided, and you knew what you had to do to avoid it, but you still ran into the road bump. But you learn so much from it that it's worth it, you know? And that's something that I think is, anybody who's starting a business needs to realize, it's a journey. There are going to be challenges, and your job is just to focus on the present and the future at the same time, but especially the present, and say, like, what's going on now? Where can I optimize? Where can I make improvements? And where does my focus need to be? And then make sure you're putting your focus in the right spots.
Yeah. There's something to be said about making the mistake yourself. You know, hopefully it's not too big of a mistake. If there's like the really big ones, you can, you know, learn from those others and avoid it. But there's just so much advice you get told, so much like things that outside, so for a while, it just turns into noise, I feel like. And until you're there, you're like, oh yeah, I think someone did mention how to get around with that. But when you go through it, I don't know. I'm personally someone who's always learned by doing. Like, I was never someone, I could read something, it would make some sense. I could hear a lecture, it would make some sense. Like, I would kind of put them together, but I could never really grasp and understand a concept until I was there and doing that. I don't know if that's how you, maybe that's why you didn't do school, but.
Yeah. Well, I definitely am. I mean, I think taking action is the most important variable. As long as you have the confidence you're going to be able to get customers, which not everybody does. So that's half the problem, right? But if you do have that level of confidence, there's almost no mistake that'll destroy your business. I'm sure there is, like, there's definitely some OGs that are going to be like, you're still young in your entrepreneurial journey, Kyle. There are big things. But I haven't come across them yet, because every single time we've had a challenge that is monetary, my response has always been like, okay, let's just close some more deals. Like, oh, whoops, we made a mistake. We spent money that we didn't get a return on. Okay, let's close another deal. Not a big deal. And that's why I'm very pro-experimented too. And I tell everybody on my team, like, if you have an idea, you want to try it out, try it out. If we lose $5,000 because some idea we had didn't pan out the way we thought it was, that's fine. Big deal, you know?
Like, it's a lesson.
It's a lesson. And what did we learn from it? And we can make $5,000 back. It's not going to be the end of the business, you know? So I try to be, you know, I disconnect myself from the money as much as I can.
Yeah, that's nice. And I mean, it's very great. You do right now run sales teams. So it's very great to know that, like, the CEO of a company like that is never worried about selling. I'm sure that also gives your customers some sort of confidence when they see you just like, sell more.
Yeah. I mean, it's look, sales is, sales is very math oriented, you know? So once you understand the math behind what it takes to hit specific numbers that you're trying to hit. So if you have a revenue target and you're doing the math on what activities it's going to take in order to generate enough opportunities in order to close enough business to hit those revenue targets, once you know the math, then you have perfect clarity, because then you just start playing with the numbers and you look like, hey, if I do 10 sales calls, I'm going to close 3 deals. It's great. Okay, we know. So how do we get 10 sales calls? And then you can try different things, you know, like, for example, our business is all inbound from our website for the most part. We get referrals as well. Those are the two sources. We don't do any outbound anymore. We tried outbound and it wasn't that great for us. It was okay. But our inbound was just such a reliable channel. And between that and referrals, we were like, well, we get enough leads to grow at the rate we want to grow.
Yeah.
Why don't we just keep focusing on the inbound channels and see if we can improve the yield of this channel versus focusing on complexity and adding different channels for customer acquisition. So once you sort of solve that problem of customer acquisition, then you're in a lot better of a spot, but it's all math at the end of the day.
Interesting. And let's say is that the same for outreach in general? Like, let's say it's someone like Yelp trying to get reviews. Not money, but there's a certain formula that would help them get however many growth of reviews they're looking for at that time.
Yeah, I kind of think everything comes down to math. You know, I tell my wife, like, we have two kids, and I want them both doing math stuff really early, because almost everything comes down to some sort of math equation. Any like result oriented thing, how many of this action does it take in order to generate that result? And then there's a formula, right? How many people do you need? This goes for every department. Like, how much time does it take to execute on this type of project? How many of those projects do we need to complete by what time? So that means we need X amount of people in order to achieve our goal. Once you know the math behind what you're trying to accomplish, it becomes a lot easier. This goes for goals. Like, I'm a big goal setter, as you know.
Yeah.
And I do the same thing with goals. It's just all math. And I try to work backwards and figure out what are the things I can control the most. And then I make those my focuses, because I know that the math will eventually work out. And if they don't work out, it's because one of my assumptions is incorrect, and then I need to adjust the model.
Interesting. Yeah. And we'll get to that goals thing in a little bit, because I really like the quarterly thing that you do. But another question that I had is, what's the story behind the name Boris? Yeah. I know it's your last name, but
yeah, it's the last six letters of my last name. There's a little story. There's nothing like crazy about it.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of a name for my blog back in the day. This is where it came from. So the first website of Boris was just a blog. I was selling my book and stuff. And a good friend of mine, David Brown, who's a really, really great salesperson. Him and I were chatting, and David's like, he's really sharp. He has a knack for like simplifying things. And he was always like pushing me, like, dude, you need like a six letter word. Like, it should just be a six letter word. And I think he even said, like, why don't you just use the last six letters of your last name? Just do Boris. I was like, okay. So that was the name of the blog. And then it kind of stuck, and I just kept it ever since.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a great story.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, there's no cool meaning or anything.
Yeah, but I think it's really cool. Something to be said about simplifying it. And it sounds, it's one of those things where like you hear it and you've never heard that word before. You're like, Boris, what is that? But as it gets repeated, you're like, ah, Boris. Yeah, the Kyle guy.
Well, one of the things I do track, actually, which I think everybody should, is a branded search. So if you go on like Google Search Console or however you're tracking kind of your keywords for your website, of how people are searching for your website, in Google, I track how many people search Voris. And that's one of the metrics I use to kind of understand our brand awareness.
Yeah, I like that. And I'm a big fan of using the last name. That's definitely going to be something I do. Even my brother's the music group that they've started is Uno Sound, because our last name is Uno, and it just sounds Uno Sound. Like, all of our friends, everyone like that knows that brand, they're like, ah, yes, Uno Sound. It just rolls off.
You're gonna have a tough time naming a company just Uno, though.
Oh yeah, I know. Trust me, I've looked. It doesn't work that way. But there's some play on words I could use. There's something fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we talked about like some of the problems that you faced, but what have been some of the successes, and how does it feel to impact these startups? Like, you as a startup company, you are going into other startups and helping them grow. Like, how does that feel from a impacting standpoint?
Feels fantastic. I mean, it's the most fun. I mean, I've always loved working with startup companies as an employee. Like, I do really well in high stress, very change focused organizations. If things are changing all of the time and there's a lot of urgency and people are, I don't know how to describe this, but people are, whatever, a lot of urgency is the best way to describe it. Then I do really well in that environment. So getting to work with early stage startup companies is a lot of fun for me, a lot of fun. So I do spend a lot of time thinking of ways that we can simplify what we do, because I think then it'll be even more impactful. But it feels really good to work with the early stage startup companies. Like, we've had multiple funding rounds. I think it's over $71 million in funding for companies that worked with us, which is unbelievable. Wow. Probably our best case study is one of our clients 3x their revenue in the first 12 months after raising their Series A, and then they ended up raising a really big Series B, which is really exciting. Lot of wins, and that really keeps us going, you know, because you have these people, these founders who have a dream, they're aspiring to do something great, and to have the ability to work with these people and help make those a reality and provide some kind of clarity, some calmness to this crazy storm, because we've been around and we've done it so much now. It feels really good. And I'm very fortunate to be in this position.
Yeah, that's awesome. And does Voris have values? I just remember, I know you guys have the vision and mission that you've told me before, but
right.
You guys have a set of values you follow?
We're still working on them. We used to, like, one of them is we never change the goal at the bottom of the mountain. And
yeah, I like that one.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. It comes from our first goal setting. Have I told you the story of this?
Yes, but I would love to hear it again.
Okay, yeah, I'll tell it. Leo and I, when we first joined forces, this was November of 2020. In November 2020, we went to Pinnacles National Park in California, and we climbed up to the top to do our goal setting, and we do it every year now. And now I'm starting to think it was 2020. Okay, so we go to the top of the Pinnacles, and we set this obnoxious goal for 2021. And we're all excited about it because we're on top of a mountain. You know, like, you feel so powerful on top of a mountain. Like, you can almost not set a small goal on top of a mountain. And that's one of my philosophies with goal setting, is change your environment. So it's so perfect being on top of this mountain, super crazy. We set these insane goals. And as we climb down the mountain, we start cutting the goal. By the time we got to the bottom of the mountain, we had cut the goal down to 30% of what the original goal was. This was a revenue target. And we were like, okay, well, now we have a more reasonable goal than that crazy top of the mountain stuff. And by the end of 2021, not only did we hit that goal, we hit that goal early, and we exceeded it by the end of the year by, I think, by like 20% or something like that. So
you exceeded the top of the mountain goal.
The top of the mountain goal. Yeah. Yeah. It went way better than we were expecting. And ever since then, I said, hey, we never change goals on the bottom of the mountain. So that's one of our values, so to speak. And we're still working on other ones. Like, I kind of like how that one is a little bit more of like a metaphor, and I want to keep them the same. So anyway, you know, like the not approved values yet, because we haven't really gotten like a cool story behind them yet, is always do what you're going to say you're going to do. Always do what you say you're going to do. You know, things like kind of your normal ones. You know, nothing too crazy. We have them listed on this whiteboard somewhere.
I really like the culture behind the story of that. I worked for this one company. The very first company I worked for was a very big corporation. And one thing I thought was really cool that they did is, after a long time of being in business, like, they've matured, they were trying to get a lot better understanding of their culture. So they hired an anthropologist to study their culture for like a long period of time. This anthropologist interviewed so many people, like, from the top to all the way to the bottom, just asking stories and hearing, like, what does it mean to be an employee here? And what they found out was there were like a couple things that just stuck within everyone. And so they turned those stories into their like guiding principles, which I thought that process was just like so cool to see how it worked, because I came well after they were already established, but like, the joke of corporate brainwashing when you're doing your training at the beginning came because we showed up and it was like, this is what we do. This is what you will do from now on. And it like,
that's awesome.
But like, it fit, like, you just wanted to be a part of this culture because everyone seemed like it was like its own cult. Like, that's one thing I really liked about that company, is like, I could hang out with the people outside of work and we were like similarly minded people. And I thought that was a really cool process, because not only did they look for that, but they attracted that kind of people in the hiring process. So
yeah, it's important. Yeah, you want different perspective, different types of people with different backgrounds. You know, want a very diverse workforce, but you want them to be kind of bound by similar values. And of course, there's company values, but there's also personal values, and there's a lot of overlap there. But the values of people is super important. And you and I can be very, very different in opinions, and we can think totally differently from each other, but maybe at our core values are so strong. And because of that, we can get along very well. you know, I think this is a really important lesson for people. And when I work with startup companies that don't have a strong grasp of this, they usually struggle.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And I like what you said. I've always been a big believer of, you could be as different as possible, but if your core values are the same, you have some sort of like unspoken bond. And I see it with, I learned this from my family, my brothers and I have, the three of us, very different personalities. Like, who we are, how we express ourselves are just the three so different. But because we're brothers, we were raised in the same household and we are like very close in age and we get along a lot, very well. It was like, we have the very same core. It's just how we go about expressing that to the world, very different. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, that same thing happens in a company, right? You have all these different people who express themselves very differently, who probably disagree on a lot of stuff too.
Oh, yeah.
But you share common values. The problem is when you don't believe someone is a good person, right? That's when really you run into chaos.
That's true. And that disagreement's very healthy. Like if you have the entire, everyone have the same mindset, you get that groupthink going and that could be very dangerous for, you know, company, friend totally. Group, family, like anything really.
Yeah. One of the things I look for in candidates when we're hiring is I look for people with who are really unique, you know, or almost strange is what I'll say is I want somebody who's different, a little off the wall. And
yeah.
That usually like, I pride myself in the ability to take a bunch of people who are very different and very quirky, because I'm also super quirky, and I can bring all those people together and we can all get along. And I just feel like there's good ideas there. It's not fun to work at an organization like that with a lot of different viewpoints. I love open debate. All of that's super fun to me. And I try to create those kind of cultures.
Yeah. And you can, it's like the, in biology, I remember this in like a biology class I took as a kid, but, you can tell how healthy a biome is by how diverse the life forms are.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. And so it's, yeah, you got your diverse life forms all in the mix and you got a very interesting thinking organization.
That's cool. I'm sure there's a lot of parallels between biology and like a corporate structure. I failed my biology class, so I don't know, but
it wasn't psychology. So we don't talk about it.
Exactly. Only psychology and speech.
All right. Well, let's get on to the habits that you have. Cause I know goal setting is a big one that, I know you've told me has attributed to your success. You never change it at the bottom of the mountain. Very true. But what are some other big habits in your life that, have helped lead to your success?
So I'm a big morning person. So I always wake up fairly early. So that's something I enjoy. I don't think it's mandatory, by the way. It's just me. I like a little silence in the beginning of my day when I get to the office. So it works out really well. So I try to wake up early. Habits wise, I do this like priming exercise every morning where I think of like things I'm grateful for. I do like some breathing exercises. It's almost like a meditation.
Tony Robbins?
Yeah, that's the Tony Robbins one. Yeah. Did I tell you about that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good
I tried it. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I think it's good.
I liked it a lot. Yeah.
It puts me in a good state, that's for sure. So I do that. Otherwise, like I read a lot. I don't really have a strong habit around reading. Like, I read every night for 15 minutes, but I do read a lot. I read multiple times per week, sometimes in longer stints than others. It depends on what's going on. And that's probably it. Those are like my main ones.
Awesome. And do you have any habits that you've had to kick to the curb that led to your success? Any bad habits that you've gotten rid of and have them transform you?
I used to be really impulsive. And I don't know if this is a habit or more of just like a trait, but like I used to send emails without reading them and they used to have all these typos. I used to like talk without speaking, and that has all sort of changed, especially in like a more of a corporate environment. I learned the hard way. I was kind of a little bit bullheaded when I was younger. You know, I was kind of a bull in a china shop. And as I've matured a bit, I got a lot better at communicating. You know, I was terrible writing emails. And then I started thinking more before I sent stuff and like how I structure things, how they're formatted. So that became a lot more helpful. I got much better optics too, which is kind of a dirty word. Like people don't like talking about it, but they're super important in the corporate world, whether you want to pretend like they're not, they are. So how you show up to work is really, really important. And I got a lot better at that when I got older in my career.
Yeah. And then that email one really hits home, at least to me. When I first started, I would send a lot of emails without double checking to the point where, first of all, whoever came up with that message that comes up when you're like attached is something and you don't have an attachment,
genius.
God bless that person, because that has saved me way more times than I like to.
Yeah, well, and it's so important because people use all of that as data points to determine what they think about you. And in a remote world, it's way harder than it was when you get to be in the office, because at least I can talk to somebody at the water cooler. Now it's like, you're judging it based on how many mistakes are in my emails, how quickly I, you know, do a task. What do I look like when I'm on a Zoom call? Like, these are the new things that people look at. And unfortunately, I feel like people are focusing less on them, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? It just depends on what your goals are. But if you're trying to move up really quickly within an organization, competence is an incredibly important part of that. Yeah. You have to show that you are a competent employee. And that comes from doing really good work, but it also comes from showing up really well. And if you can do both those things, then you're going to, that's a recipe for success, and you'll move up very quickly.
Yeah, I agree. It is, it's especially tough to all the employees out there who graduated in 2020 or 2019 of college. Mm-hmm. And all they know is this working world. Like, that's it. And so, very much something to be said that, like, I remember, because to me, I've always been big on when speaking and talking to someone, being mindful of body language. Mm. And then you have that entirely cut off now. Work is like purely the faces. Like, even that alone, you take out an entire very important aspect of communication to where it's, And then email, you take out the other important one, which is tone of voice. So there you have tone and body language out, only reading the text itself. That can make it a little dicey sometimes, getting to know someone. I mean, obviously it works for a bunch of other things.
But I mean, getting to know somebody, but also somebody you know, right? Like, how many times have you misread an intent behind an email? You know, it's like, happens all the time. So your ability to communicate really effectively is super important right now. And like I said, people judge you for it. You know, if your emails look like shit, people are going to think a certain way about you, and it's just the reality. And you could argue that they shouldn't. The way you format an email should not dictate your career trajectory. I agree with you. Unfortunately, it does, because it's what people are using to make judgments of you as a person and as an employee. So it's an important variable, and we could do as leaders, we do whatever we can to try to prevent that from being one of the data points we use, but it's very, very hard not to, because it's a subliminal, you know, it's a subconscious thing.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be like someone showing up to work every day, shirt untucked, you know, back when you would have to look nice, your hair disheveled, you look like you just came out of bed, still got the beard, like, raggedy. It's like, you could be as good an employee as possible, but we're like, as much as people don't like to admit it, we do judge books by their cover. That's why books have covers.
Yeah.
It's so that we can pick which one we want to read if there's no recommendation. Like, it's just what's going to happen. And I think that's, that's becoming the new way of, I mean, I go to work in my PJs sometimes, but I guess I definitely don't make cold calls. Dude, you gotta really be looking good, feeling good to be making those calls consistently, I've noticed.
Well, one of the interesting things too is if you look at like, look at like direct-to-consumer brands, like consumer packaged goods, they spend a ton of money just A/B testing different packaging. Mm-hmm. What sells more, what sells less? Like, all we do is judge books by its covers, right? Like, if we didn't, we wouldn't put so much effort into this. You know how much Apple spent to figure out how to lay out their stores? Like, this is part of consumer behavior. And to think that that doesn't go on at your organization when your job, your career progression is on the line, you're crazy.
I just want to take a second to thank you for listening.
You judge books by their cover.
Totally. Well, I do think that's important. And for a long time, people kind of said production quality doesn't matter that much. And I think for a while it didn't. But right now we live in a world where, for the most part, you believe you're going to get what you're promised, right? If you talk to 10 consulting firms and they're all telling you they're going to help you build their sales team, you're going to believe that all of them are going to be able to help you build your sales team. So what other variables are you going to use? Do I like the person that I'm talking to? Can I see myself working with them? Are they a good fit for the team? Is their methodology aligned with what I believe our company, with our company values? And in addition, how do they look? So it does matter. You know, I put a lot of thought into our video quality, the quality of our podcast, the amount of hours I've spent just playing around with audio equipment is out of control. You know, it means something to me. It's important to me. And I think those things matter, but they're less tangible and harder to measure. So a lot of people ignore them.
The thing is, they're very subconscious. They're not things that you're thinking about at the front of your brain, like, oh, I'm picking between two podcasts. Like, yeah, I'm listening to this episode, but the quality is a little scratchy. Like, maybe something weird's going on. Like, you're not thinking about that when you're, unless you're like an audio person, but for the most part, you're not. But when it comes down to deciding, you know, subconsciously, I fully think that people are aware of the little tiny bits of detail and effort you put into it. Like without thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they definitely are. The counter argument to this is if Elon Musk was on a podcast with bad audio quality, people would still listen to it. Oh, yeah. Right. So there is a strong argument for the other way.
Dan mentioned something very similar to this actually. And it was like a moment where I was like, damn, that's some good advice. What he said, we were talking about copywriting and he said, you could have the best copy in the world and your neighbor could have very average, mediocre copy. But if their messaging is better than yours, they will get more, they will book more meetings. It was like,
of course,
talking about writing emails. But it did hit me that I was like, you could be the best writer. Like you could make your marketing message sound the best. Well, the writing itself, the words, whatever, how as pretty as popping out. But if the message you are trying to convey doesn't shine, then it's just not going to be successful.
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to relevancy, right? How relevant is what the person, what you're reading to you as a person? Yeah. You know, like in those old, you know, there's like those old jokes in movies where it was like, are you struggling with losing hair? Is your name Bill? You know, and you're like, oh wait, my name is Bill. Same type of thing. You know, if you can describe the pains that the people are going through that when they come out, when they want to come and talk to you, then they're going to talk to you. You know, I forget what our headline is on our website right now, but I think it's we build B2B sales teams or something like that. It's like just literally the simplest version of what we do for that exact reason. Like you don't want people to have to think too much to figure out if this is something that's going to be a good fit for them.
Yeah. And there's one thing I remembered about a conversation we had recently about burnout. And I really thought this was cool. What you mentioned is that burnout to you is kind of like a marker for your limits. And it'll tell you where you can go, where you can push, and when you can handle more the next time. Can you elaborate that?
Yeah, totally. I'm not very concerned about burnout in general, like with people. Like I never give advice around burnout where I'm like, oh, be careful of burning out. Like it's just not my place because what burns me out doesn't burn anyone else out, right? Or vice versa. Like it just, everybody's different. And if you are going to give somebody advice and you're going to say, hey, be careful to not burn out. It's like, it's Siri talking to me now. Siri said, I'm not sure I understand. Shut up, Siri. Yeah, I didn't finish my point. Anyway, so it's important to me that you are self-aware. That's the important thing. And if you're feeling burnout, you need to analyze why. What's going on right now that is causing me to experience burnout? And once you understand that, then you can then avoid those things in the future to prevent that from happening again. But what I will tell you from my experience is there are things that used to make me feel burned out that don't make me feel burned out anymore. You know, an example I always give is 2 weeks ago, I had my calendar. I had like 38 hours of external meetings. Yeah. So not even including internal stuff, just with clients. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's a lot of meetings. Okay. I don't even know how many hours I worked that week. It's just insane. And I felt fine. I felt super fine. 3 months ago, I had a 31-hour external meeting week. And I remember telling my wife, like, I can never let that happen again. Like, I'm going to lose my mind.
Yeah.
Times have changed. And now we're starting to go the other way because we onboarded some people who are help lightening my load, et cetera. So that's good. I won't have to run into those things. But look, I can do really high output and not get burned out. I know my limits. And if I do start feeling burned out, I'm going to do what I have to in order to organize my life in a way to where I can start releasing some of that tension. And then we're going to be back to normal again. But to stifle your own growth or to throttle what you're doing because you're afraid that you might burn out is irresponsible. Like once you start feeling burnout, that's your body telling you something. So listen to that and make changes accordingly, but don't try to avoid it because you'll never know where it starts.
Yeah. And I really like that. One thing that it makes me think of is when you're going to the gym and you're trying to increase your weights and get stronger, you don't add, you know, 5 pounds every week indefinitely until you run out of weights. Like that's just not possible. You add some weights. And when you start getting to that point where you're plateauing, you either take a rest week or you do a deload cycle where you just do like 60% of what you normally do. You basically give your body a little bit of time to heal and then you go back up and you find that you can break through that plateau. And I mean, yeah, that's the way I see it for there.
Yeah. I mean, I think it applies exactly the same.
All right. We got, we talked a little bit about burnout, your habits, and now I want to talk about the fun stuff you like to do, your hobbies. And I will say, Kyle, I actually watched a documentary on this game that you like to play just to see if I could figure it out. Yeah, I did. And dude, it is fascinating.
It's crazy. Yeah. What documentary did you watch?
It was like a Vice one. So I don't know.
How interesting. It was. I feel like I might have seen that one. No, it's a crazy world. Yeah. I mean, Magic the Gathering. It's a card game. It's something I really love doing. I don't have nearly enough time to do it anymore. I fell in love with card games when I was a kid. Yeah, I was like part of like more of a nerdy group. And we used to play back then, we played Yu-Gi-Oh! A lot. And really? As I got older, like I kind of changed the games that I played. I stumbled upon Magic at a certain point and then just started playing that. And it's great. It's everything that I like. I like competition. I like learning, trying to improve. I like what feels like infinite ceilings where like there's just constantly next levels you can go.
Yeah.
And I also like being around people I enjoy being around. And you get all of those things with Magic. It kind of scratches this competitive itch I have. There's constant growth and I can see strong progressions and I get to be around friends and hang out and not talk about work. So it's kind of the perfect hobby for me.
Yeah. Where I was told is that they mentioned it's similar to a combination of the luck of poker with like the strategy of chess. And I was like, oh, I really like those two games. Like if that's like a, you know, kind of similarity, I'd like to give it a try.
Yeah, that's what everybody calls it. It's a mix between chess and poker. One of my problems with chess, which is why my problem with it is why everybody likes it. It's kind of the perfect game. There's no variance. It's genuinely just you play against me and it's a skill game.
It's
there's
purely
no variance.
Skill.
Yeah, there's no variance at all. I like variance. It makes
there's
it a little
no
more
randomness,
fun.
No luck. Nothing. It's like if they are better than you, they will beat you 10 out of 10 games.
Right, right. Exactly right. And I would rather that be 9 out of 10 because there's nothing more fun than like stealing a win that you shouldn't have gotten. And Magic adds that element to the card game that's just what makes it fun. Same thing with poker, right? Like sometimes you win a hand in poker that you had no business winning just because
100%.
Just the way the cards fell, right?
That's so, the story of me playing poker.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
Winning hands
out.
I shouldn't have won.
Yeah, that's good. So yeah, Magic does a really great job melding those two. But at the end of the day, the better player will win over time.
Like over X amount of games.
They'll almost always win. Yeah. And to the point to where like if there's a big enough gap, it's almost impossible. I mean, they would have to get incredibly unlucky for me to be able to beat them. If I went and played somebody who was, you know, one of the best players in the world right now, they'll smoke me every single time. And maybe I'll squeeze one game out if they get incredibly unlucky and I get lucky. But odds are I'm not winning a game.
Yeah. And how serious did you get into Magic?
Pretty serious. I used to travel all over playing tournaments. There's a term.
Did you make money?
I've won prizes. Yeah. Yeah. But not like a salary type of money, but there's prize pools and stuff. I probably won, I don't know, maybe a grand, you know, around there over all the play. You don't really play it for money, and there's very little money in it until you get to like a much higher level. And even then, most of the money comes from content.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, bigger prize pools for sure. But like once you get to the really high level, so if you think of it this way, there's once you get to the elite level, there's a small difference in how good a player is from anybody else. And that's where variance, you feel variance a bit more like, oh, that person just got a little lucky. But there's some people who are just freaks. And I don't know about you, but I love seeing people who are really good at their craft.
Yeah.
I find it super fun to watch Magic and watch these players that are really good. And yeah, you're right. It's super entertaining.
I love watching people when they're in the zone.
Yes.
When they, because that's when someone is instinctively not thinking, like they're just, it is their element. They love the game. Like, you know, the best example is Jordan in basketball, right? Yeah. He was so creative. You watch some of the slow-mos of the stuff he's doing. Like I remember watching The Last Dance, and there was one move where I had to rewind at least four times because I was like, dude, you could have given me a million tries to play basketball and I wouldn't have even thought of like half of that move that he did. It was just so creative and fun to watch because that's like when people are in the zone, that's when they're having their fun. That's when they're just letting their genius shine.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you seen the Kanye documentary?
Dude, I'm watching it right now. Have I ever told you that he's my favorite artist?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm actually like a really big fan, been following him for a long time.
Yeah, I'm a big Kanye fan too.
Oh, we have a lot to talk about then.
Yeah, for sure. But that documentary, but dude, so I watched the first episode. Yeah. I'm probably going to watch the second one tonight.
Second one's better than the first. Unbelievable.
Oh, is it really?
I think so, yeah.
Dude, I was brought to tears in the first one.
Dude, the second one is the story of Through the Wire.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so yeah, I'm very excited about this. But really that first one, dude, I have like a page of notes that I took just from watching it because I found his determination so inspiring. And just, you know, he says his one line at some point. He said, like, before I had a car, I used to walk to the bus while practicing my Grammy speech. Like, how cool is that? You know, just to say, like, I'm gonna be great and I'm not gonna stop. And just those scenes, the fact that it's all on video is miraculous, but those scenes where he's like talking to the admin at the record studio,
that one gave me chills.
In front of him. Oh my gosh, dude.
That he's amazing. Walking into every single room and playing his songs and everybody's ignoring him. They're talking to their friends. They're doing anything but listening to him and he doesn't care. He's just still performing his songs in front of them and they, no one takes him seriously. They're like, dude, you're not a rapper. You make beats. And if you think about it, like, he could have lived a very cozy life. Dude, you sell his beats for like $50,000 a pop. Like he could have made a great life just making beats, but he's like, no, I'm a rapper.
I tell people. I say the same thing. Like this guy could have made a great living just making beats, but he refused. And he's like, I'm going to be a rapper. This is what I'm going to do. And his determination, his will, and his self-belief is what got him there. And regardless of what some people think of Kanye right now, and you know, some of it I think is warranted. You have to respect where that man came from, and he got there because of him. I mean, he truly got there because of him. And
dude, he's a billionaire.
Yeah, I mean,
he's worth like $1.8 or $9 billion. Like,
yeah, and I give him a lot of credit. I mean, hopefully, people watching the documentary will understand the person a little bit more. I sure walked away understanding a bit more about him, and I found it incredibly inspiring.
Dude, to me, it was mind blowing to see that the stuff that he said about himself back in the early 2000s is the stuff that just now, 20 years later, is coming to fruition. Like he recently, everyone was like, dude, that's so weird. You changed your name from Kanye to Ye. He like legally changed his name to Ye. But if you listen in the documentary, in 2002, Kanye said he was pissed off because someone wrote Kanye instead of Kanye West. He's like, I want him to know my full name. He's like, maybe by the time I get famous enough, they'll just know me as Ye and that's it.
Yep.
And like now that's what he calls himself. Like, I don't know. It's just like the little things that his self-belief to me is the most impressive part.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I was so inspired by that. And I remember that part where he said, maybe they'll know me as Ye. And I thought that was it's just a great documentary. I recommend everybody watch it. I had a ton of takeaways. I found it incredibly inspiring. I was pretty fired up after I watched it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great detour. One of my closing questions is about like the kind of music you listen to. So so we'll get to that. Cause I'm a big, I'm sure you can tell I'm a big music person.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, I actually did have one other question about Magic. I was like really curious when I was thinking about it, like looking into this game. I was wondering like the application of, you know, how they're coming out with like a lot of NFTs and like real use cases in, you know, 10-15 years have a lot to do with games. You think there, I saw the fact that it's card games and NFTs could be like almost trading cards in themselves. Do you think that's ever going to come together?
I think so. And any Magic fan watching this is going to know what I'm talking about, but I think so. I just don't believe Wizards of the Coast, who's owned by Hasbro, who's behind Magic the Gathering, has the capacity to make that happen. I think they're such a poorly managed team. There's no reason why Magic shouldn't be the number one card game on the planet right now. And it probably is in a physical card game, but they got smoked on with Hearthstone. And the fact they turtled up during COVID when they should have pushed digitally. The people who run that company, I just think, have lost their spark. They don't have the drive anymore. And they're just looking at how they can squeeze as much cash out of the community as they can. And it's unfortunate.
That's tough. Yeah.
Yeah.
The reason I thought of that is because of how serious they were. There was one little segment on it, is they were really taking the actual art behind the card itself very seriously. And that's what struck out to me. Like, yeah, dude, some of those drawings like of the OG cards were
so cool.
Were beautiful. Like to themselves, they're beautiful pieces of art. And like, to me, like anything that can be art can be turned into an NFT.
Yeah, I mean, I do. And I dabble in the NFT, like, you know, crypto world a little bit, especially recently. I wanted to learn it. So I learned by doing, similar to you. So I just sort of bought some and tried to figure it out. And I think it's a cool space. I would love to see them get into that, but they need new leadership in place. You know, I think like I just feel like COVID was such a big missed opportunity for them. You know, like look at UFC, like what Dana White did during COVID with the UFC was amazing. And the fact that he had the courage to keep pushing when everybody else was retracting and they were calling him crazy and he was doing it anyway, whether you like Dana or not, you know, that's up for debate. Sure. And I agree with both sides on this, but he did the right thing and people aren't calling him crazy anymore. And it's one of the biggest sports in the world.
And you're a big UFC fan. That's another huge thing I'm going to talk about. Who are some of the fighters that you've been keeping up with lately?
Israel Adesanya is probably my favorite fighter. Yeah. He's
phenomenal. I like him because he's a showman, man.
Yeah,
like, he puts on a show when he fights, and he's so good.
So good. I'm a big Derek Lewis fan. I watch every Derek Lewis fight, the Black Beast. That guy's super fun to watch. Yuri Yohaska. I forget how I pronounce his last name. He's a kind of an up and coming fighter. I think he's really good. Sean Strickland's putting on some good shows right now. Obviously, there's Khabib's protege, Islam Makhachev. He's fighting this weekend. I'll be watching that. There's a lot of fight. I like, my favorite. One of my favorite fighters is Alexander Volkanovsky. And the fight between him and Brian Ortega, I think everybody should watch. One of the best UFC fights I've ever seen. Because at one point, Alexander Volkanovsky gets caught up in a guillotine from Brian Ortega, who is just vicious on the ground, and you know, you don't want to get guillotined by Brian Ortega. And he's in the guillotine, I believe it was 26 seconds. Now, for those of you who don't know, when you get into like some kind of choke, it's not the oxygen that's the problem. It's actually cutting off blood to the brain. That's why you pass out. And he's in there for a very long time, wiggling, and this thing's in deep. And he through the will of a champion, is able to get out of this. I mean, unbelievable. If you watch the round, like it afterwards, you know, commentators were like, we saw a champion spirit right there. It's a special moment in UFC
did
history,
end up
in my opinion. He does end up winning. It's unbelievable.
That is pretty gnarly.
Yeah, it's crazy. He gets caught up twice. You just watch the whole fight. It's bananas. He gets caught up twice. He gets out of them both times. And, you know, there's this really crazy picture of his head all purple because he's in this guillotine and he's just staring at Brian Ortega, like with
his head's
these
purple.
Eyes.
You probably see the veins popping
out.
Oh,
totally. It's crazy. And he gets out of it and then he gets caught up again and then he gets out of that and he ends up winning the fight. Unbelievable fight. And that guy's that guy's a champion. I mean, he's a really, really good fighter. You know who I saw live? I saw the Colby Covington, Kamaru Usman fight live in Madison Square Garden. This is like bucket list. And that was a really great fight. So anyway, I'm a big UFC fan and I've been for a while, and there's no better time to be a fan than right now. I'm so happy there's so many people who are into it now, because like I feel like I could watch UFC with a bunch of folks that I couldn't before.
And have you ever done any martial arts?
No. I mean, when I was a kid, I was in like Kenpo for a couple of years, but not, you know, seven.
Yeah.
I have a couple memories from doing that, but not really into it.
Yeah.
I'm not a fighter. I don't like hurting people. I feel bad.
You just like watching them.
Yeah, just each watch other. Yeah. It's actually odd that
for absurd amounts of money.
Yeah, for absurd amount of money, for sure. But yeah, it's super fun. I love UFC.
That's sweet. What other hobbies do you have? Because I know we've talked about. Are you still doing stand up? I was gonna say that you also like fishing and smoking.
Yeah,
meat.
Yeah. I have a lot of hobbies, to my wife's disdain. I have a weird problem where I have to go like pretty deep into anything I get interested in. So I do a ton of research. I try to like buy everything, and you know, it's a mess. But yeah, I love fishing a lot. You know, smoke barbecue. I have a smoker. I take that pretty seriously. I have a ton. I can't even remember any other ones. Yeah, I mean those are probably I get into stuff for sure.
You don't do stand up anymore. I feel like that was a big part of you early on.
It was, yeah, because the time stand up's a very unique craft. It's not something you just stand up and do, even though it looks like that's what's going on. It's a lot of writing, a lot of testing.
And I have to do.
Not even, you know, like name a comedian.
Well, no, I mean they make it look like they stand up. I understand it takes like an insane amount of dude. That's one of those things like that is similar to music where it's like you could be doing it for 10 years and then all of a sudden this person blows up and they're like, wow, look at this overnight success.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
They've been touring. They've been like across the country 4 or 5 times now, performing in every small place you can imagine, and now they started making it big with a special, and you're saying they just showed up. Like
it's very similar.
So much.
It takes so much work. And one of the big differences between let's say I played guitar, and which I did when I was younger, but let's say I played guitar and that was like my hobby. I could go to a bar and play guitar for the evening, and you know, with a little tip jar or whatever. And you know, I go to restaurants all the time, they have somebody playing guitar. You can't really do that with stand-up because you have to write, and then you go and test, and then you change, and then you test, and you write, and then you change, and then you test. You just keep doing it, and it takes so much time. It's kind of like writing an original song, and like but a little bit different. It's just because the audience participation is so important in stand-up, right? It's just audience is so part of the performance that it's very hard to just, I'm going to go do stand-up tonight.
Because like with music, I know what you mean by the, you could play someone else's song. Like songwriting in itself is something where it would take a lot of time. And I see that with other people. But if you're just performing other people's songs, you could do that and it can be background music and it's a pleasant atmosphere. You don't really need, like you could still be having a dinner conversation with music back. But when it's comedy, it's like you're going to see comedy.
Correct. And that's the big difference. That's what makes it tough to do as like a little hobby. You know, I feel like when I get older, I'll probably start doing it again, I'm sure. But it's just not something, and I also like, I'm so passionate about it that I couldn't half-ass it. I'd have to be like, I'd have to really dedicate myself.
Yeah, I can see that. All right. Well, now I have just 3 final questions to close it off. Quick
hit
ones.
Me.
Yeah. And selfishly for me, I love hearing what people do, what kind of media they consume, but also to anyone else, if anyone's interested in hearing, let's get right down to it. What kind of music have you been listening to lately? Or is there a particular artist or song that you like?
So there's 2 genres of music I listen to, which is crazy. It's hip hop and or I guess more rap and country. Those are my 2 favorite genres.
Interesting.
A little bit opposite ends of the spectrum. Yeah, I grew up listening to a lot of country with like my parents, and as a kid, like I loved hip hop, rap. You know, I'm a big rap fan, so I probably listened to that the most, with country coming in close second.
That is something, they are opposite ends on the spectrum, but something I've been saying for so long. I'm a big rap fan and I listen to country, but it's not something that I shoot. Like I listen to it when other people are playing. I'm not going to be like, oh God, get this out of my ear. I listen to it, but there's like a handful of songs that I have on my playlist, but rap I listen to a lot, and I hear a lot of people on one side saying to the other, like, oh my God, it all sounds the same. Like pop country all sounds the same versus pop rap sounds the same. Dude, I realized they're both saying that pretty much the same things. It's girls, drugs, money, and performing. Like that, they're all saying the same thing. It's just in two very different languages. So.
Right, and there's stories. You know, even like my favorite rap is very story driven. Same with my favorite
like
country song.
I'm guessing.
Yeah, I like J. Cole a lot.
Lyrical.
Yeah, I love the lyrical stuff. You know, Joyner Lucas, I like Jid. If you're familiar with him, I'm a big fan of his. I'm a huge Eminem fan from when I was a kid. I actually have a pretty cool autographed picture of Eminem from Rap God in the other side of the office, which is super cool. Yeah. Anyway, so there's a lot of artists I like, hip hop artists, and then like country and stuff. But yeah, that's mostly the music I listen to. But awesome. I don't listen to music that much. When I listen to music, it's probably rap, but I listen to a lot more like podcasts and like YouTube videos. And
I was going to say, I think I have to switch up that question and say, what's your favorite song or podcast? Because I've noticed there are some people who don't really listen to music that much anymore. Podcasts have really taken over.
Yeah.
Like the listening, everything. Yeah. But that's why we're here. Do you have any type of, what's your favorite show or movie? Do you watch any of those?
I'm a big Scorsese fan, so any Scorsese movie I basically like. Taxi Driver is probably like one of the older favorite ones. I love Taxi Driver. I really like, any Scorsese movie I like. Wolf on Wall Street, I think, is a great movie. The Irishman that just came out.
I was going to say, what did you think of The Irishman?
I loved it. Except I was a huge De Niro fan as a kid. And then he went through that weird stint where, like, I think he got, like, divorced and, like, his ex-wife took all his money or something. And he's just like, I got to do movies.
Making every movie.
Yeah. He was a gay pirate in some random movie. Like, he just was taking every role. I'm like, this is a gangster. Like, what's he doing playing a pirate? Anyway, so he's doing whatever. But in a role that he's supposed to be in, like, I'm a big De Niro fan. Show wise, so I don't watch a lot of like story driven show. Like, I watched You recently on Netflix. That was really good. Archive 81, I think, was a good one.
The first two seasons of You.
Those are some that I get into, but I don't normally, you know, get into those long narratives because they're a big investment. So I like mostly watching documentaries.
They reel you in.
They do. And so I watch documentaries. I watch a lot of trash TV with my wife. Like, we watch reality shows. Survivor's one of my favorite TV shows of all time.
Survivor's sick.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan.
And finally, what book are you reading right now? I know you're a big reader.
I am. Yeah, I'm finishing up. It's so funny because I was supposed to be done with it already, but I got too slammed to finish it. Story Brand. It's kind of how to message your brand through story.
Oh, interesting.
Wow, yeah, it's like good. That. It's really good. Yeah, it's called Story Brand. And that author, Donald Miller. Donald Miller is the author. He's great. He's a great writer. His podcast is really good too.
Sweet. I'll check it out. Yeah. I like hearing book recommendations. That's kind of why I do this. I like hearing people's recommendations. And honestly, like, I really think I've always been someone who believes that if you know what someone listens to, you'll get to know who they are.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably true. You know, I listen to a lot of Tony Robbins stuff. Les Brown's one of my favorites.
Les Brown's good.
Yeah, he's really good. Book wise, I read a pretty all nonfiction, but I read, you know, The Talent Code I just read recently, which I thought was fantastic. Buddha's Brain is one of my favorite books. It kind of talks about the neuroscience behind like mindfulness practices. It's very good. Those are probably like the ones that are most top of mind. The Five Dysfunctions of a Team is a really good book. Extreme Ownership is my favorite leadership book. Radical Candor is the other one.
Any fiction books? Or do you keep it
nonfiction? No, I keep it nonfiction. I just can't, like, you know, I don't know. It's just Leonardo drew his sword. It just doesn't make me excited anymore. When I was a kid, I used to love them. I will say I got into biographies, which are kind of fictiony, right? They're story-based. And one that I'm not done with, because it's insane, it's so long, it's like 1,000 pages, is Titan. It's about John D. Rockefeller. It's incredible. It's crazy. He had an insane life. He's definitely worth reading that book, but it's just a big investment.
Yeah, biographies are definitely, I do like nonfiction books. because they're like, I like the ones that are like 200 to 400 pages.
Yeah.
Because then I feel like when I'm, I don't know about you, but like when I'm going onto it with a book for a little too long, it starts to get, I don't know. I just like the change up. I like, I like different authors' writing styles. Like I can't read the same author back to back because I like getting different styles and like different perspectives. Yeah. And so when I'm reading one book, I've been reading Principles for a while now. I really like that book. Love that book. Ray Dalio is such an interesting person, like his life. This book is thick, man.
Yeah.
And after a while, it's like, I need a break because I've just been hearing straight Ray for like a month now. Yeah. Like, need a second.
Well, that's a good book to just have and every now and then read a piece of because they're, you know, it's all cut up into multiple different principles.
Yeah.
And you can just read them standalone versus having to like read it cover to cover in one sitting.
Yeah, very true. All right. And finally, where can people find you? You got your own podcast.
I do. Team. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you, I mean, Voris.com, V-O-U-R-I-S, Voris.com is the best place. I'm on LinkedIn all over, you know, that kind of everywhere. We have a YouTube channel and they'll find me if they're so willing.
All right, Kyle, thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah. Anytime.